so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
You know, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, December 1st, 2017. I am your host, Jillian Walters, and I am joined here today by our control room operator, Allison Cole.
Hi there.
And our guest host, King the Vegan Kid.
Hi.
Welcome to the show. So how can we as animal advocates best help the animal liberation movement? Why do some people continue to be part of the system that exploits animals? What is the most effective way to communicate with non-vegans? These are some of the questions I will explore with Casey Taft for our feature interview coming up in about 20 minutes. Casey Taft is a professor of psychiatry at Boston University School of Medicine, internationally recognized researcher in the area of trauma and the family, and co-founder of Vegan Publishers. He has won prestigious awards for his work from International Society for Traumatic Stress Studies, the Institute on Violence, Abuse and Trauma, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He has published over 100 journal articles, book chapters, and scientific reports, and has consulted with the United Nations on preventing violence and abuse globally. He sees the prevention of violence towards animals as a natural extension of this work and has written two books, Motivational Methods for Vegan Advocacy, A Clinical Psychology Perspective, and Millennial Vegan. Looking forward to that.
So you wanted to talk about the Health Canada, right?
Yes. I have been updating listeners whenever I'm on about the Health Canada as it prepares to roll out the new Canada Food Guide. Now, the draft of this new guide, if you remember, eliminates the dairy category as one of the food groups, recommends Canadians eat a high proportion of plant-based foods, and emphasizes plant-based sources of protein. And last time I talked about how Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada had been secretly lobbying Health Canada not to encourage a shift towards plant-based eating because it would, and I quote, have negative implications for the meat and dairy industries. So there is a petition that you can sign, and you have until March, I think, to sign that petition, just letting Health Canada know that we want our food guide based on science and not to be influenced by lobbyists.
And it does look like that's coming as well, because reports are showing that dairy is going to be off the menu as a required food group for the Canada Food Guide.
Yay.
I'm looking forward to that. So last week, across the world, activists celebrated Fur Free Friday, and we had our activities here on the weekend last Saturday, and you, Jillian, I think you too, Kingston, you're both there during Saturday's events, and I saw some of it online, and I want to know what happened. What took part on Fur Free Saturday last week?
It was fun. It was exciting. Two groups partnered together, actually three, PETA, Direct Action Everywhere, Vancouver chapter, and Anonymous for the Voiceless chapter, Vancouver chapter, came together. There was about 20 plus people. Some people were new. And we came downtown. We walked up through Holt Renfrew, did a speak out, then walked through Pacific Center with security guards hightailing us out.
Oh, I thought you were going to say they were coming with you and
no.
they're being friendly and escorting you, right? No? Okay.
No. And then we went up to the art gallery and had a speak out there, went up Robson, past Uggs, and...
And Uggs is just the worst, I think.
Yeah.
Lambskins, that's just one of the worst things that you can support.
And then we finished at Snowflake.
So I was able to see there was a couple of videos taken at Snowflake, and I don't think you were there, though, but there was a video that Daphna took of someone who was either working in Snowflake or she was a patron there, and she had some interesting things to say, which I think can sort of symbolize to me, sort of the persona of the average fur wearer. What would you say, Jillian? Like, she was saying some pretty crazy things. Like, she was saying to the people who were protesting, she was saying, your face is leather, your hair is fur, therefore you're hypocrites. She actually called people hypocrites. What do you think of that?
Yeah, it's laughable, but it's laughable, but it's, I mean, it's what we're up against. I mean, the mentality is she was very serious in what she was saying.
Yeah. And I've met people like that who are, you just can't convince them otherwise, and they are very ingrained in their very illogical reasonings as to why our views against animal exploitation are wrong.
Yeah, and it's interesting, like, how angry she was at us.
She was directing the anger.
Yeah.
She had a lot of anger to direct, so it had to go somewhere.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
So what better than to, you know, 20 compassionate vegans who just want exploitation to end for animals. So how was your experience going around to all the stores and that?
It was good. I mean, we actually had some receptive people in all of the locations, but eventually when security caught on, they were asking us to leave, so...
And you kindly left.
Yes, we did.
Okay.
Even though they were quite aggressive about it. But we calmly and peacefully left.
Well, I want to say that there are so many stores out there. Kingston actually pulled up a list that's at humanesociety.org if you want to look of all these stores and designers and brands and labels that are going fur-free. And most recently, we had reported on the news that Gucci is now planning to go fur-free. And I think the reason was something like because it's no longer, or it's now cruel to use fur, like not like it wasn't before, right? So they're acknowledging that, and they are taking up that stand along with other designers such as Stella McCartney and Calvin Klein and Steve Madden and many actually stores too that you just see in the mall, like Club Monaco was on that list, and Abercrombie and Fitch, that was on there too. So there's lots of stores that are actually taking a stand now and designers to go for free. And I wanted to mention that even I saw this on the news, it might have been like Entertainment Tonight News this week, on this letter actually, Pamela Anderson, who's a well-known vegan animal advocate, and she actually has a clothing line that makes faux fur. She actually sent a letter to Kim Kardashian earlier this year. It was just a few months ago, saying, encouraging her. She sent her one of her faux furs, and she encouraged her to not wear real fur, because Kim Kardashian is one of those celebrities who wear real fur. And I wanted just to read a little bit about it here. She writes, I think you'd be horrified to learn that every single fur farm that PETA has exposed has been beyond cruel. Investigators have witnessed and documented that foxes are electrocuted, dogs are bludgeoned to death, and raccoon dogs are skinned alive. Just last month, video footage from a fur farm in Poland revealed that foxes are being kept inside filthy, cramped, dark cages, and that some had missing eyes and rotting jaws. The footage was released on the heels of another investigation showing that foxes are being selectively bred to grow an enormous and dangerously unhealthy size so that their pelts will be larger and fetch more money. And then she goes on to mention that times are changing and people are starting to take a stand against fur. So it's time that people in high profile positions who other people like to look up to on Instagram or whatever, on social media, they need to stop. They need to start being role models, and they need to stop wearing fur. And I think it's coming. What do you think, Jillian?
Yeah, it's a shift, right? It's a shift in our beliefs. And unfortunately, it's the famous people that are going to have a big impact on, especially the younger generation. So, you know, if they stop wearing fur, maybe, you know, lots of people realize it's not cool, so they won't wear fur either.
The reality is that fur kills, and I'm seeing a lot of Canada Goose jackets these days, which really make me sick. Actually, you know what happened? This is like the second time this has happened. I've seen at my gym, someone just puts their $1,000 Canada Goose jacket in the locker without locking it. And so this week I made, and then I'm seeing it a lot at my workplace too at UBC, right? I'm seeing a lot of students who can afford $1,000 jackets. I'm seeing them wearing them. And it's on my to-do list to start. We actually posted some resources on one of our fur-themed shows earlier this year on leaflets and little brochures that you can print out, just little pamphlets that you can actually just give to someone you don't know who like maybe you can't stop to have a conversation with them, but you can give them a fire to show them the realities of these coyotes that are being caught in leg traps to show where that fur trim comes from. So, if
you're looking for a coat this winter, as I was like, oh, where am I going to go to find something that's not, that's, you know, cruelty free? So there's Woolly Outwear, Noise,
great, yeah.
Aritzia, Le Chateau, Franken Oak. There's a few stores that focus on non-cruel coats.
All right. So, yeah, I think we're going to do our, PRA after. So let's do some events now. Is that good?
Oh, I thought we were doing the PRA.
On Saturday, December 2nd, in Vancouver, Chicken Saves weekly chicken vigil at the Hallmark Chicken Slaughterhouse. We come together to bear witnesses and record abuses. People are invited to hold signs and wave to drivers by and open people's eyes to the fact that this gray building is in fact a slaughterhouse. This event starts at 9 a.m. and goes until 11 a.m. On Sunday, December 3rd, join the DXC team as they head out to Wabatats in Richmond for their monthly volunteer and potluck day. Wabatats operates a shelter in Richmond housing around 90 mostly adoptable and adorable wabbits. Bring a vegan dish enough to share for lunch. Also on Sunday, Vancouver Chicken Safe and Liberation BC are hosting the annual Santa Claus Parade leafleting event to raise awareness about the plight of turkeys at 10:45. We will meet at the city center SkyTrain station to disrupt the leaflets. Later in the afternoon, anonymous for the voiceless, Vancouver chapter is hosting a queue of truth at 3:30 to 6 p.m. At the Vancouver Art Gallery on Watson Street, AV brings the information to the people in an attempt to show the cruelty in Canadian meat, dairy, and egg production. We will also be offering the public an opportunity to experience life from a livestock animal's purveyance with virtual wildlife technology. On Thursday, December 2nd, from 1:30 to 1, join the PETA and dress like an inflatable baby as they protest the BC Dairy Industry Conference.
Great job, Kingston. So next weekend, December 9th and 10th, the Vancouver Chicken Save and Liberation BC welcome Chris Van Breen, one of the founders of Direct Action Everywhere, to present Intro to Kingian Nonviolence and Reconciliation. This transformational two-day workshop exploring Dr. King's philosophy of nonviolence and the strategies of the civil rights movement. This workshop has helped thousands of people in various social justice movements, as well as in prisons, law enforcement, schools, and other communities, to understand the depth of the philosophy of nonviolence and conflict reconciliation. If you're an organizer working for social change, an activist working to reduce violence in your community, a youth worker organization, or just someone who wants to learn how to resolve their personal conflicts better, this workshop is for you. And lastly, I'm holding this new hot off the press poster for a massive event that's happening to bring in the new year, and it reads, join us for the biggest and most powerful animal rights outreach event in Vancouver history. One cause, one massive screen, 3 days, 5 organizations. Anonymous for the Voiceless, Direct Action Everywhere Vancouver, Vancouver Chicken Save, Liberation BC, and TV Outreach for Animals are joining forces for this one incredible event. Make history with us at the Broadway and Cambie SkyTrain Station, December 29th, 30th, and 31st at 4 p.m.
That sounds super exciting. I'm not going to be in town. I'm going to miss that. But wow.
Yeah, it's big.
Thanks for breaking that. And do we have more details of what's going to be happening there?
Yeah, actually, you can go to Facebook.
Mm-hmm. So we should post a link on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll do that today if you can get that done. And I have an event, too, to announce.
Right.
Yeah, so I organize events sometimes, and as you may know, I'm one of the co-hosts of Vancouver Meatless Meetup, and I decided to host a dinner that's happening on December the 8th, and I highly encourage you to check it out if you're sort of, like, vegan curious, or you want to meet people, or you just want to go out and have a good meal, or you want to bring your friends. A lot of people come alone. And this is the Meatless Meetup group. It's found at meetup.com/meatlessmeetup. And you'll see the event listed there that I'm hosting. It's called the Dinner at Pan's Veggie Restaurant. And it's on December the 8th. So we will have a set menu of 8 courses that are going to be $20. Cash in, that's $20 cash with tax and tip included. And everyone's invited to come. All you have to do is sign up on that meetup group, and it's free to do, and you just RSVP, and I shall see you there next Friday, December the 8th. So, yeah, if you have an animal-friendly event that you would like to have announced on the show, you can send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com, or you can post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. So we have some news now, and there's some breaking news for this week that I wanted to talk about, which has to do with SeaWorld, actually. A judge has granted class action status in a SeaWorld lawsuit. So, yeah, let's chat about that. So U.S. District Court judge granted class action status for a SeaWorld lawsuit that accused the company of misleading shareholders about impact from the documentary Blackfish. Judge Michael Anello issued the order this week for the lawsuit that was filed in 2014 in the Southern District of California. And in the lawsuit, a group of investors accused SeaWorld executives of ignoring and denying the backlash caused by the film that examined a trainer's death and practice of holding killer whales in captivity. Now, Jillian, you and I are very familiar with the film Blackfish. That film came out in 2013, which is when this all started, like the stocks of SeaWorld started going down. And Blackfish is a film that exposes the controversial captivity of killer whales and the unjust cruelties that lies beneath this very exploitative industry. And I sort of want to get to know, like, your thoughts, Jillian, on how this, how you see that this film has impacted the industry and the way that people are viewing and patronizing SeaWorld now.
Yeah, it's had a huge impact. I mean, personally, it was the movie that got me to become more active. Like, I watched that and I said, that's it. I am going on the front lines. I can't take this anymore, because I was a vegan for many, many years and just kind of quietly doing my own thing. But that was so impactful to me that I started to get more active. And it's just changed. It's amazing what a movie can do, right? It's changed so many
people. The power of film.
Yeah.
There are so many other documentaries and a few that have come out this year as well, such as What the Health, that are changing people's minds and that are just educating people. Sometimes it's easier to watch a film, a 90-minute or 60-minute film, than to read a book, right? Reading a book can take hours and hours and days and weeks of your life, and some people aren't readers, but pretty much anyone can watch a film. And that's why I always encourage my friends who are not educated in these areas yet, and that's why I buy films too. I will give them the DVD and I will ask them to please watch this film.
And they're so accessible, and you know, it really influenced a lot of, again, famous people who decided to take a stand as well and not perform at SeaWorld. And
that's true.
Wasn't like that.
The Bare Naked Ladies was one of them, right? They decide, and then there was another group. There was a change.org petition that went up encouraging one of these very famous musical artists to boycott SeaWorld, and they got so many signatures that, of course, they did. Mm-hmm. So SeaWorld is going down, and this news story of this week is further indicative of that. Internal emails released in the court case showed that SeaWorld executives complained about Blackfish hurting business in late 2013 or early 2014. That was just when this film was coming out, months before the company admitted in August 2014 that the movie has hurt attendance, the lawsuit said. SeaWorld does not comment on pending litigation. The company remains ever focused on our mission, they say, to inspire people to protect animals and the world's oceans. And this is what the Orlando-based company said in a statement. I would say I have to disagree with their mission of, their supposed mission of inspiring people to protect the ocean, because if you really want to inspire people to protect the ocean, you will do that with animals in the ocean and animals that are not kept in captivity in tiny little tanks where they are forced to perform tricks. And we've had that here at Vancouver Aquarium as well. We're having successes there.
Mm-hmm. And right? It's so archaic. I mean, to watch a beautiful, massive cetacean or an animal in an enclosed space do tricks, it's just disgusting.
I was going to say in 50 years from now, this will be seen as an archaic practice, but now I'm going to reduce that number to even 5 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
Because these places are getting so much negative feedback because people are learning the truth. Their eyes are being exposed to realities, especially because here in Vancouver, activists are really making a difference. I went to the aquarium last week, actually, after Chester the false killer whale died last week. Yet another death at an aquarium. It's their 42nd death since they've been open. When will they stop? Well, there's only one more animal left there now, cetacean, unfortunately. And we want that animal put into the wild and released into a sanctuary. Whale sanctuaries are coming.
Yeah, and there was an interesting conversation, I don't know if you saw it online, from somebody that works there coming out and trying to talk, to try and understand our position. And
I saw a bit of that, yeah.
Yeah, and just the total lack of understanding and seeing kind of the people on the outside as...
It's really hard when people they have been fully brainwashed.
Yes.
Because you would think that the basic person with no, say you just go into this, say you're an alien from another planet, and you come into this and you don't know anything, and you see these animals, say you identify as being a human animal, right? We're all animals. And you see these beautiful beings, because that's what they are. They're beautiful creatures, just like we are. And they're being kept behind walls or bars, literally. And they're forced to swim in these tiny little tanks in circles where they go crazy. And because they're used to having enormous depths of the oceans, they're used to be able to swim with their families because they're animals that really identify with being in pods with their families, right? And say you witness this and you see that this is the way that these humans are keeping them. Like, how would that make you feel? Right? You would think that would make anyone with compassion feel that that's wrong and realize that that's wrong.
You'd think so.
Yeah, but we were seeing otherwise. So, yeah, I'm not sure where people can see those videos were posted on Facebook last week. Maybe we can find that one particular one, or there was two of them, and we can find them and post them on our Facebook page. I think it's just good just to see where other people are coming from to educate people. And, yeah, so that's what's happening in SeaWorld. And let's see if there's anything more about that. Oh, yeah, they have a landslide of new attractions coming next year, by the way, because they are phasing out. They are phasing out. Last year, SeaWorld announced that it's ending the controversial practice of breeding, and that's because their biggest breeder, that was Tilikum, he died.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why that happened. But they said that their breeding's going to be phased out. Theatrical whale shows are going to be phased out at its park. So if you're seeing a whale show, that this is your last chance. But don't buy a ticket. Don't support them. They're evil. And they're going to be focusing on whales' natural behavior, so they're going to get more into rides and stuff. So you have a new story for us.
Yeah, well, actually, just breaking news, the Vancouver Aquarium says the preliminary results from a necropsy show a false killer whale that died, Chester, died from a bacterial infection. So they are now treating Helen with antibiotics.
And Helen,
they shared...
Helen is the porpoise that lives there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that would seem that maybe she likely has the infection that Chester died of.
Right.
Right? Seems like a lot of their necropsies are showing mysterious bacterial infections.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about that on the show before as to how they can get those infections with being in contact with humans all the time, which they normally wouldn't be, right?
So I have on many occasions been frustrated that a loved one or a friend continues to be part of a system that tortures and kills animals in the most horrific ways, even when they know the truth. This frustration led me on a quest to find out why. So last year I started doing some research and I found Casey Taft's book, Motivational Methods for Vegan Advocacy, A Clinical Psychology Perspective. As a registered clinical counselor and a vegan for many years, reading this book was like finding gold. He has since written Millennial Vegan, which is such an empowering book for all vegans navigating in a non-vegan world. And I am happy to introduce our listeners to Casey Taft. Welcome, Casey.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for your kind words. I'm glad my book had some kind of positive reaction to it.
Yes, it really did. So let's start with the reason that propelled you to write Motivational Methods.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm a clinical psychologist. I've been working, doing clinical research for about 15 years now, working primarily with people who engage in partner violence, mm-hmm. and mostly court-ordered folks. And I've developed programs to prevent and end that violence. So I've done a lot of studying and research and teaching in the area of trying to motivate people to change who really don't want to change, mm-hmm. especially problematic violent behavior. And as an animal advocate, I was just finding more and more that the kind of stronger I became in my advocacy, the more I kind of got involved in that world, the more that I realized that there was really a lot that clinical psychology could offer to animal advocacy. And I thought they were kind of concepts and kind of strategies that we all use in clinical psychology that really weren't being applied to animal advocacy the way that I thought it could. So for me, it was just one of those things where I just felt like I couldn't keep it in anymore. I just felt like I had to get this out there. So I just started to write what I really thought was just going to be a short PDF that we would give away on our website, something just to be useful for folks. But ultimately, I just kept adding to it and kept adding to it and kept thinking of more things I wanted to say. And next thing I knew, it was long enough to make it a real book. So that's what I did. And I've been really happy with the response it had. It was never something I ever really planned to do, but it just sort of happened.
Yeah, I'm so glad you did. You say that the abolitionist perspective can serve as a foundation for powerful animal advocacy when approached from a motivational perspective. Can you elaborate on this for our listeners?
Sure. Yeah. And I just to make it clear, I don't think of myself as an abolitionist. I think, you know, folks who use that term, oftentimes they're thought of, you know, as kind of coming from a very specific school of thought, and, you know, particularly, you know, Gary Francione and all that kind of stuff. And I don't really identify that way, but I certainly identify with the idea that we should be promoting veganism, only veganism, as an end goal. And I feel like, unfortunately, a lot of younger folks in particular who are coming into the movement are kind of getting these messages that I think are really harmful for animals. And I feel like they don't really make a lot of sense from a behavior change point of view, from a psychological point of view. And they don't make a lot of sense from a social justice point of view either. So you get all these advocates out there saying we shouldn't be talking about asking people to go vegan or to end their animal use, and rather we should just be asking people to cut down on eating animals or cut down on eating certain animals or whatever. And it's just really kind of confusing messages that a lot of animal advocates are getting. So I think the part of the book that you're referring to is where I think having that stance that we should be promoting nothing short of veganism, nothing short of ending all of our use of animals, that kind of wedded with a clinical psychology motivational perspective, I think can be a really powerful intervention. Oftentimes things are pitched in these kind of all or none kind of terms, like either you can be this kind of, you know, aggressive, like angry abolitionist vegan who's attacking people, or you can be kind of this kind, compassionate reducitarian, as if those are the only kind of two options, when the truth is you can have a really clear stance about ending our the harm that we're doing towards animals and also being kind and compassionate at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a topic that comes up a lot in the vegan community. Do you see, because it's mostly the large animal advocacy organizations promoting reducitarianism, do you see they're changing their stance anytime soon to more of a vegan message?
No, unfortunately, I don't really. Mm-hmm. It's been quite a while, and really none of the big groups really promote veganism, and they never really have.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether this is something that they're intentionally doing or not, I think it's hard to ignore the fact that there are kind of powerful forces that can kind of shape a message of an organization. And one of those forces is to remain in business, basically, and to raise money, where every organization is concerned with kind of staying afloat and expanding, getting bigger, all those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, it's a lot more profitable for organizations to promote kind of softer messages.
Right.
To promote messages that, you know, those who aren't vegan, who aren't really kind of animal advocates, will be more likely to, I guess, feel good about. So most of these animal groups are raising money for their organizations largely through non-vegans. So it stands to reason that if they put out kind of softer messages that appeal to non-vegans, then they will get more funding from non-vegans. So you'll get a lot of people who donate who think, well, you know, I could still kind of consume animals on a part-time basis and still feel good about myself because I'm kind of contributing to these groups.
Right. So how can we as activists get these large organizations to promote veganism? Is it possible?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I think for me, I do all that I can to kind of point out what I think is harmful advocacy. I do all that I can to point out things that I think are harmful. But you know, focusing too much on trying to tell everybody that these organizations are doing it wrong is not necessarily, I think, the way that we're going to create the big change.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of feel like putting, and this is the way I've always kind of, I've always worked in my day job as well, where if I think I know a better way to do it, I feel like it's more effective for me to kind of show that that works.
Mm-hmm.
And to, rather than to try to just get into these philosophical debates and say, well, you're doing it wrong, you're doing it wrong, as I think people tend to be more, I guess, kind of swayed and moved by actually presenting kind of a positive model for how you can create change. So
nice,
that's mostly what my focus has been. I don't have great hope that we're going to kind of change all of the larger groups. I think they're reinforced too much to kind of keep doing what they're doing now.
Right. You mentioned something in your book. You say that mainstream animal advocacy groups determine how to best encourage people to stop exploiting animals by asking those who are doing the exploiting. Can you explain what you mean?
Yeah. Well, this is something that it came up in a conversation I think I had with Will Tuttle a while back, a year or two ago. And he told me that he was talking with somebody who is, you know, high up in one of these large animal groups, and that they told him that they put out these kind of reducitarian messages. They ask people to go vegetarian rather than vegan, or to just stop eating one particular animal and you can keep eating the other animals, because through their survey research, they found that those are the kinds of messages that people like the best, right? So, and again, it goes back to what I was just saying. So if people consume animals, you know, we see this all the time. When we hear from non-vegans and they say, well, what you should really do is not really talk about animal rights. You should not really talk about social justice. You should just be showing them good examples of good vegan food and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we hear from a lot of non-vegans because they don't want to be reminded of the harm that they're doing.
Right.
But if you really think about it, you know, if we really want to help these folks change, we don't necessarily ask them what that change method should be or the message that would work for them, because if they knew the message that would work best for them, then they'd probably already be vegan as it was.
Exactly.
In my day job as somebody who works with domestic violence perpetrators, I don't develop my curricula based on what abusers tell me, you know, I should be telling them, mm-hmm. right? I base it on kind of what we know is effective, what we know is influential, how we can counter kind of sexist views. We don't necessarily ask like the sexist violent people like, well, how do we change you?
Yes.
And then build our program in that way. It doesn't really make a lot of sense, but it seems like that's exactly what kind of the large animal groups are doing. And again, I think that works a lot better for raising money. It works a lot better for fundraising than it does for creating change.
Right. That makes sense. So having done the majority of my counseling work with people in addiction treatment, I'm very familiar with the stages of change model, and it is one of the reasons I was drawn to your first book. For our listeners, can you describe the stages of change model and how it translates easily to vegan communication and education? You just started to do that.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So the stages of change model is really a simple concept. That really was first developed in the substance use field.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that in order to best influence others, it's important to think about their readiness for change or what their stage of change is. And when somebody's changing a problem behavior, they usually go through a series of stages in changing that behavior. When we're talking about animal advocacy, when we're talking about veganism, the first stage is really pre-contemplation, and that is when the person is not even thinking about changing. So a pre-contemplator in terms of animal advocacy would be kind of the bacon trolls that we see on our Facebook pages.
Right.
People who have no intention of changing, no interest in it, they're not even thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Then contemplation is the next stage, and that's where they're actually starting to think about it. They're starting to think about both sides of it. So maybe they'll say, well, yeah, like I don't want to contribute to harm to animals, but I really love cheese and it's really hard for me. So they're kind of thinking of both sides of, you know, they're reflecting both sides of their ambivalence.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have preparation where they're actually starting to decide to make that change and they're getting ready to do it. And for those folks, they might require a totally different message. So for folks who are preparing to make the change, introducing them to nutrition facts or health tips may be especially helpful, while those in the earlier stages of change may require more discussion about ethics and to try to really make them see the need to change in the first place. And then you have the action phase where they are making the change or they've already made the change, and the maintenance phase where they're trying to maintain the change. And for them, really providing support is really helpful to provide a sense of community and to help make sure they don't backslide.
Mm-hmm.
So there's different interventions that may be differentially helpful depending on where somebody is. And too often in animal advocacy circles, we hear folks who will say, well, you know, that's not the way to help somebody change. You have to do this or you have to do that. And the truth is that there are many different strategies that may work depending on what stage of change somebody is and what their barriers for changing are.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I love how you've translated that to the animal rights movement. It totally makes sense for me. So you have over 200,000 followers and have observed many non-vegans go vegan as a result of using the stages of change model. Do you have some real life examples that you want to share with us?
Oh, sure.
What stands out for you?
One recent example is my father-in-law recently went vegan.
Oh, wow.
To be honest, there was not, I can't really take credit for it. I wish I could, but I think more than anything, my wife and I, she runs Vegan Publishers with me,
mm-hmm.
recognized that there was only so much that we could say,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I mean, most of my communication with him made me more in the pre-contemplation to contemplation stage and not really even thinking about changing.
Mm-hmm.
So he was exposed to what we were doing with Vegan Publishers and my books. He read my books, and I think he read my books. So he was exposed to all of this that we were talking about, but we knew that there was only so far we could push him.
Right.
And in fact, he said that to us after he went vegan, that if we pushed him too much, he knows that he may not have gone vegan at all, or it may have taken him a lot longer, because he had to do it kind of when he was ready to do it. He just wasn't ready to do it before. And I think we knew that. So we didn't push it. Mm-hmm. We didn't push it too much. Now, that doesn't mean that we weren't kind of clear in our vegan advocacy and how we think that, that everybody should be vegan.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't compromise our message at all. We didn't promote reducitarianism or anything like that. We just knew that there was a limit to how much we could kind of try to kind of compel him to change.
Mm-hmm. What an amazing example. That's awesome. As a psychologist, you have expressed that assertive communication is the one skill you would, and I'm quoting, bestow on every vegan in the universe. Can you explain why this is so vitally important and an example of what it looks like?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think assertiveness is a key skill for just about anything, mm-hmm. whether we're talking about our personal lives or professionally, our mental health is something that is really central to the programs I developed and run for domestic violence. And the idea is to find that middle ground between kind of keeping everything in and holding in and stuffing your feelings versus being overly aggressive and engaging in name calling and put downs and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And too often in animal advocacy, I find that folks fall on kind of the different ends of that, the different extremes of that continuum, where you get a lot of folks who will tell me after they read my book or hear one of my talks, they'll tell me, I tend to be that passive vegan where I don't really talk to other people about being vegan. I don't even tell them that I'm vegan. I just kind of keep it to myself. And then you have the other extreme where you have the more aggressive folks who are out there calling, people who eat animals, murderers or a lot worse.
Yeah.
So we know that neither one of those forms of communication is effective for animal advocacy or just effective communication for anything, for mm-hmm. any relationship or anything where you're trying to help somebody change. So being assertive really is just about finding that middle ground where you're respecting the other person, you're not name calling, you're not disrespecting them, but you're being very clear and you're being very honest with them. And you're also being respectful of yourself because you're not stuffing your feelings. You're not keeping everything in. You're just saying how you feel. You're just telling the truth in an honest way. And definitely what I've experienced, what I've witnessed, are the most influential vegan advocates are those who can calmly and rationally communicate the vegan message in an assertive way. I definitely see a lot more change when people are able to communicate that way than either passively or aggressively.
Right. That makes sense. So many animal activists have histories of experiencing trauma and abuse, and it's one of the reasons we can identify with the pain and suffering of non-human animals. As activists, we are awakened to the horrific abuses happening to animals on a daily basis. How can we protect ourselves from re-traumatization?
That's a really important question. I think it's such a big issue in mm-hmm. animal advocacy. So many animal advocates, like you said, go into animal advocacy in the first place because at some point in their lives, through their own experiences of violence and trauma, they've decided that they are going to fight against needless violence towards others.
Mm-hmm.
So many become animal advocates because of their own experience of needless violence, and they decide they're going to try to help prevent violence towards those who are kind of the most kind of defenseless among us, including non-human animals. So a lot of us are already coming into animal advocacy with a lot of trauma, and then we're traumatized left and right by all the violence that we're witnessing mm-hmm. towards non-human animals. And of course, unfortunately, animal advocates engage in aggression towards each other way too often. So we experience, needless aggression and violence that way as mm-hmm. well. A lot of psychological abuse. We experience abuse from loved ones, from non-vegans, and trolls or people who are trying to, upset us in various ways.
Right.
There's all different kinds of sources of trauma all around us, and we have to really be aware of what we're exposing ourselves to, and we have to learn to set limits. So part of being assertive is setting boundaries and limits. So that may involve setting boundaries and limits with abusive people. You know, it may involve deciding you can't spend time with this person or that person, or you need to block this person on Facebook, or you need to kind of unfollow certain people or pages that are exposing you to a lot of violence and trauma. So for everybody, it's different where their boundaries and limits are and what they need to do to kind of take care of themselves. But it's really important for everybody to be aware of this for themselves, of what those boundaries and limits are for them, so they can try to not, you know, traumatize themselves. Because the more trauma one experiences, and the more likely we are going to go to that kind of dark place where we just see everything is terrible, we get depressed, and we get misanthropic, and we just think the world is a horrible place. And that's a really bad place to be, you know, personally and also as an animal advocate, because we're not going to be as effective and influential if we just think the world is totally, you know, crap, and that, you know, and that everybody sucks.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. And then it leads us to burnout, and that was my next question. You know, I've experienced burnout within myself, and I recognize it in others, and I'm wondering what kind of advice can you give to activists coping with this? You've touched on that.
Yeah, I think really kind of how I was just describing it is, as long as you are mindful of your limits and you really are always paying attention to that, you're going to have a much better shot at avoiding burnout.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you really do have to take a break. A lot of my friends take prolonged Facebook breaks because they really need to, because you're just constantly exposed to trauma, and there's only so much that you can take.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I think it's different for everybody, but also having positive things in your life is really important, you know? Like,
yeah.
I know, for example, Joanne MacArthur talks a lot about the importance of spending time at animal sanctuaries. So you're not only seeing the violence and the trauma, but you're also seeing animals who are happy and healthy and in a much better place. So finding some way to kind of balance off all the violence and trauma with something positive, I think, can be real helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very helpful. So just touching on communication again, communicating with non-vegans, you mentioned recognizing our own personal triggers when discussing veganism is an important tip. Why is this so important?
Well, that's just kind of a basic anger management strategy that I think is helpful in general.
Yeah.
For all of us, there's usually one topic or one thing that somebody else can say that will really kind of set us off.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be different for different people, for different loved ones. And it's just good to be aware of what some of your kind of hot spots are, your own hot button issues or comments. So when it does come up, you can kind of tell yourself, you know, to just kind of, you know, say something relaxing to yourself, or tell yourself, you know, just to, you know, take a break, or, you know, cool off a little bit, and to not let it get to us. So it's good for us all to be aware of what are some of the things that others can say or do that are really going to set us off, so we can be emotionally prepared for it when it happens.
Exactly. Yeah. So I was so excited when you devoted a whole chapter to coping with anger, because there's that dance with animal activists with the dance of anger. Like, you know, you feel anger, when to express it. You don't want to come across as the angry vegan. So that's what kind of advice do you have around that?
Yeah. I think anger is so important. That happens to be the area where I've had so much experience in my day job. So I definitely wanted to bring that in.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there's so much I can say about anger. I don't even know where to start. I guess one thing that I'll say is that it's okay to be angry.
Mm-hmm.
That anger is a normal, natural emotion. This is something we say in our anger management groups. There's no way that we're going to take away anybody's anger. And I'm more concerned when I have somebody tell me they don't get angry at all than when they say they get angry a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're in denial of your anger, it probably means you're stuffing it, and it's all going to come out in some harmful way, or you'll keep it in and you'll become depressed. So anger is healthy, but But the important thing is how you're dealing with it, how you're expressing it. So it's potentially healthy, but you have to express it in a positive way. So if you express it in an assertive way, where you're not letting it, you're not keeping it inside, you're not letting it fester, you're going to be a lot happier and healthier than if you're just keeping it in or you're just blowing up at other people. I think too many people are too worried about being thought of as that angry vegan. You know, I think that's sort of a stereotype that's out there to silence animal advocates, just like we have the stereotype of the angry feminist or the mm-hmm. angry black man. Mm-hmm. These are kind of used by others to silence us. And unfortunately, I think it works because a lot of animal advocates, a lot of vegans really do kind of keep all their feelings to themselves because they're so worried about being thought of as that angry vegan. The truth of it is there's a lot of reasons for us to be angry. There's a lot to be angry about if you really think about all the harm that non-human animals are exposed to by people who we love and care about. It's really hard to see people who we know are otherwise kind people to directly do harm to animals. That's really difficult to deal with, and it can make us angry, and that's okay. But it's how we deal with that's what's most important.
Yeah, and I'm really glad you brought that up in your book and we're discussing it today, because I think we need to honor that we do have anger and we're allowed to express it in healthy ways.
Right, yeah.
So you summarize 4 tips for animal advocacy. 1, consider others' readiness to change, which we discussed with the stage of change mm-hmm. model, the importance of relationship, promoting veganism, and 4, being morally consistent. Can you elaborate on the 4th one, our duty as vegans to understand other forms of oppression and be aware of our own oppressive behaviors?
Yeah, I think that's really important, and I think that's a big issue in the animal advocacy world, this idea of intersectionality and what it means to be pro-intersectional. And if that somehow takes away from the animal advocacy movement, if we're also talking about oppression towards humans, I think there is this fairly sizable portion of animal advocates who would describe themselves as more misanthropic, and they'll describe themselves as animals first and essentially say they don't really care about human oppression, or that's not something that we should be talking about. And I think that's a real mistake, because it makes us look like hypocrites. Mm-hmm. Because if we want to convince other people that the use of non-human animals is a social justice issue, then we have to show that we care about social justice in general. It doesn't make any sense to only care about injustice towards one species or one, just like it doesn't make sense to only care about certain animals and not others. It's just ethically inconsistent to say we only care about injustice towards non-human animals and not towards humans. You know, and how people want to spend their time is one thing. You know, if they want to focus their efforts on animal advocacy, that's fine, and that's totally up to them. But it's completely counterproductive to put out the idea that you don't care about other oppression or that you don't care about other people's suffering, because really that's no way. It's morally inconsistent, but it's also no way to build a movement.
Right.
You know, if we really want to have a big change, if we really want to, you know, if we want a vegan world, then we're going to have to find ways to connect with all these other social justice movements and really kind of bring them all together and really focus on all issues of oppression and injustice if we really want to have a big change.
Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad you brought that up too. So the holidays are approaching and we vegans are about to face one of the most difficult parts about being vegan, and that is sitting at a table with friends and family that we love, where animal corpses are being celebrated and eaten. You talk about viewing these people as pre-vegans as a way to deal with the situation. Can you elaborate?
Sure. And I didn't invent that term. I'm pretty mm-hmm. sure Will Tuttle uses that term. Maybe Colleen Patrick Goudreau. I'm not sure, but it's a term that's been out there. It's definitely, I much prefer it to other more pejorative terms like mm-hmm. carnist, mm-hmm. Because it has, it is more hopeful.
Yes.
Right. To think of others as pre-vegans, even if we don't use that specific term, just to think in that way that others all have the potential to go vegan, and I believe that they will go vegan. And it also reminds us that we were once in the same place that they were, that were most of us, and mm-hmm. very few of us were vegan from birth, mm-hmm. and that many of us were in the same place that they were at one time. So for me, it's helpful for me. It helps me from going to that dark place, to have that more hopeful perspective and to really believe that others will change, but they just haven't made that connection yet.
Right. And you can see kind of where they are on the stages of change model and that they have the ability to move.
Exactly. Right.
So just before we end, I always ask the question, how and what kinds of things do you personally do for self-care?
Good question. I guess it may sound a little cliche, but spending time with my family is mm-hmm. probably the best way that I engage in self-care. Spending time with my 4-year-old girl, mm-hmm. Lena, it's really hard for me to get too down or depressed when I get to spend, you know, all this time with this like wonderfully happy, you know, little girl who's just always laughing and joking and playing. So mm-hmm. that's really helpful for me. And I guess I'm lucky, and I'm lucky in a lot of ways, privileged in a lot of ways. And one of them also is that I feel like I have several outlets where I feel like I'm able to make a positive contribution. So so my day job preventing domestic violence is very rewarding to me, just like my animal advocacy work. And what I kind of discovered early on in when I was in graduate school, is the more that I would pour my energy and efforts into trying to prevent violence and help others, then the less depressed I would feel. So I find that the more that I feel like I'm doing something positive, the less likely I'll get depressed and burnt out. But there certainly are times where I need to talk to somebody, where I need to talk to another, you know, animal advocate, another friend who can relate to what I'm dealing with and help prevent me from feeling that burnout.
Right. Thanks, Casey. So it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show today. I love your two books, and thank you for sharing your wisdom and empowering others with the work that you do with these two books.
Thank you. Thanks so much for talking to me. It was a lot of fun.
Okay. Take care, Casey.
All right. You too.
Bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us on our next show on Friday, December 8th for our annual International Human Rights Day. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Stream shows or download shows or podcasts, read our show blog with detailed links, and subscribe via iTunes. Stay in touch with us via our Facebook page. You can also send us messages or suggestions and comments about the show, either on Facebook or via email, radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. To end today's show, we have my favorite latest musical soca artist, Amni, singing Veggie Man. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
Your feet, you get my taste nice. Hot, right, and dry.
We don't want no more. We don't want.
socialism got you folded, blinded. Your leaders misguided, binded, widened. The hide the truth, cause this could have well been avoided. There is a health crisis, disease is running rampant, and you act like it's niceness. Your body's not a grave, you're burying animal corpses. Flaws is in not them laws, is obvious, but them causes to make a profit and never losses.
No,
we don't want no more, we don't want no man, we don't want no Ike, we don't want no clock, 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 we don't want no more, we don't want no man, we don't want no Ike, we don't want no clock, 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 clock. The veggie man, the veggie man, the veggie man, and beans and grains and leaves and roots and seeds and don't give it all that. And roots and seeds and no give me no doubt.